This is Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington, and I'm catching up with Marty O'Donnell. Wow, it's so much fun to have a chance to talk with you again.
Oh, thanks, Kate. I really appreciate you spending the time talking to me.
Well, you know, we talked last year just as you were in the home stretch for your Kickstarter campaign for Echoes of the First Dreamer, and wow, you're really coming down to the wire. It was kind of a nail biter there right at the end, but you wrapped it up successfully, and so congratulations.
Yeah, there was a point in the middle there where I'm thinking, I'm not sure if we're going to actually hit this, but we not only hit it, but we exceeded it. And I got to tell you, one of the funny things that happens, apparently this is how Kickstarter giving actually goes over time. You have a little bulge at the beginning, and then you get most of it towards the end. Because apparently people like to be able to say, I put it over the top, so everybody's waiting until the very end. I didn't know this. It was, you know, scary.
Yeah.
But one of the things we did at Highwire, we thought, well, we'll prime the pump a little bit. Jamie, my, you know, business partner, started putting money in without me knowing it. And then as money would come in from other people, then he would take the money out. So I'd see it go up, and then I would see it sort of go down again. And I'm like, Jamie, what's going on? He goes, oh, yeah, well, I was trying to make sure we were going to hit over the top, but I didn't want our money to be in there. So I kept seeing it sort of do this little up and down thing, and that was because he was manipulating the numbers. But we made it, and we made it by, I think we succeeded it by like 10 grand or something, so it was fine.
Wow. Well, the end result is absolutely fantastic. It's a CD of music that I guess you've called kind of prequel music for the game that Highwire's working on, Golem. And so once, and I totally want to dig in and talk a lot about the music because it's just, it really got to me, honestly.
Great.
After the Kickstarter finished, what were like the steps that you needed to take to get this to the point where it is now, where the album is just about to be released?
Well, it's funny. I just recently, within the last month, I re-listened to the interview that you and I did last year, and it was interesting to hear the fact that, like, at that moment, I really had done almost nothing. And I was slightly panicked about, like, yeah, now that, you know, this thing is funded, I actually have to do it, and I have to actually write. And, you know, I talked about, you know, Eric Satie, and I had some general thoughts of directions I wanted to go in, but I didn't know if it was going to work or not, and I hadn't written the majority of anything. So it was sort of nice to see, okay, a year later, I actually kind of did what I said I was going to do. So that's why I'm really glad I'm talking to you again, because you're actually one of the first people to, you know, outside the performers and so forth, to hear the music finished. So I'm, you know, I have no idea how, if people will like it. So I'm very happy that you like it.
Yeah, it's been it's been a real honor to listen to it, honestly. And for anyone who, you know, contributed to the Kickstarter and was a little worried that maybe the music wouldn't sound like you because you weren't writing for Myth or Halo,
right,
we can put those fears to rest, because it does. It sounds like you. Your DNA is there, but you've got such a new feeling with the music. It's really, really interesting. You know, I can hear little echoes of Reach and Myth and your other pieces, but it just sounds like it's coming from a completely different place, which is so exciting.
Yeah, that was on purpose. I was really hoping to come from a different place, and I wanted the story and the you know, the background of the game we're making, Golem, to really try to inform me of what this world would be like. And one of the things that I made a conscious decision, and it was hard because I'm so used to reaching for the drums and the timpani and the giant percussion, is I made this decision basically, which is, who's the band? Like, who's going to be performing? Who's playing? And I wanted it to be piano, harp, and chamber orchestra, and no percussion. And sometimes just making that decision just is going to inform you about many, many things. And so it, I, you know, it doesn't have some of those big bombastic moments that people might be expecting, but it's a different story. It's a much more intimate story. It's magical, and it's about kids, and it's about looking at this magical place through the eyes of children. So it's a different thing.
The piano playing in the release, the solo piano pieces, are just so wonderful. They almost sound kind of improvised. And as you were working on the recording, who did you choose to be the pianist?
Well, yeah, that's me playing piano. And I hate to admit it, I wish I was as good as it sounds, but of course I'm fixing anything. Any mistakes that I make along the way, I make sure get fixed. So, but all this stuff is playable. And it's not like I cheated on that side of things. It is playable, but I found some of it to be like, wow, I really need to practice this. I need to really go over these couple of bars because this is not easy. But some of it is deceptively simple sounding. And I'm not just saying that like to pat myself on the back. I just mean that like I want things to sound like Satie. It sounds simple, but when you actually get into it, or Mozart, let's say, when you actually do it, you're like, oh, I have to work at this. This is not an easy thing. What you want it to sound like it's easy and flowing, but there are some technical challenges hidden in these pieces.
It sounds just so quiet. And it's an interesting process to listen to it because I don't have any game references. I have no
Right.
memory of playing the game where I heard this music for the first time. So it's kind of like free association, which is really an interesting experience, unlike, listening to Halo or Myth or something like that. This is an obvious question, and normally I try to avoid these, but the album is called Echoes of the First Dreamer. And so I'm just curious, who is the first dreamer?
That is a good question. These terms like the dreamers and echoes and sleepers and endless city, these all come from the game, and they essentially come out of Jamie Griesmer's mind. I don't think we're ever going to say who exactly the first dreamer is, but this sort of magical ability to be a dreamer in the world of Golem is the foundation of what you do as the player as you play through the game. But we're fictionalizing it. And so it just, I think primarily it's just sort of a cool concept and a cool title. And we're not going to reveal who the first dreamer actually is. And I'll tell you one of the other things I sort of like is I think you can read into it some deeper meaning, sort of like creation and you know, what does it really mean to dream and dream things into existence and you know, so there you go. It can have very deep meanings, I think. And of course, it could just be something cool from a game. So there you go.
So we're saying, yeah, multiple levels.
Yes.
What's been so interesting with the first pieces that you sent me for our interview a year ago, to hear how they've become the seeds for all of the other music in the album. And the one that really struck me is the song for Children's Chorus, the Golem song. And there's one phrase in particular, "If I catch us, we dream no more." And so
I
that's.
know. Yeah, you know, you get a little chill when it's like this cute little thing and the kids are singing and their lyrics are a little bit strange. It has to do with the elements in this world instead of, you know, earth, water, fire, air. It's these other things that also came out of Jamie's mind, and it has to do with how you play the game and construct things. But we wanted it to sound like this is the kind of a children's rhyme that kids would sing on the playground in this world. So they don't play hide and seek, they play seek and hide, which is sort of interesting, which means the kids in this society go out and they're looking for treasure, but when the sleepers awake, when the golems come out, they have to hide. And if they catch us, we dream no more. So that's it's sort of like, to me, I was like thinking about Ring Around the Rosie and how cute a song that is, but it actually has to do with the plague of smallpox or something. It's some horrible plague that they sang this nursery rhyme about.
Because, oh, what is it? Ashes, ashes, all fall down was actually the sneezing, which was one of the symptoms of the plague, and then you fall down and die, so.
Yeah, it's just horrible. So, but that's what kids do in a society. They make some sort of game out of even tragic things. So we thought that would be sort of fun. And it was cool because I got my friend Joe Krenko, who is the children's choir director here in Seattle, and he got me some boys and some girls that would sing for me. And they came and sang, and then I said, okay, now at the very end, I just want one little solo voice to sing We Dream No More. And all the kids were just old enough that they sounded really good, but they didn't really sound like a little kid. And there was the younger sister of one of the kids there, and I looked at her, and her father was there, and I said, does she sing? And he goes, yeah, she does. And I said, could I try it to see how she sounds? And she was just great. So it was, you know, I've worked with kids before, the Flintstones Vitamins kids, so it was fun to get her to just sing that little last part.
Idea that as you're working on your soundtracks, you kind of imagine words that'll fit the motives that get embedded in the score, kind of the DNA of the score, like in ODST, All Alone, or the little Destiny, the little chords. Did you have any phrases or words that you used to kind of get your ideas going for this project?
That's interesting. No, actually, I didn't have because the very first piece that I grabbed for was something that I had written 35 years ago. Oops, I just revealed my daughter's age. So there you go. I wrote it when my first daughter was born. It was just a lullaby on the piano. And when I was thinking about Echoes of the First Dreamer and music for this, I think my wife said, you should use that lullaby. And it just has this da 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 da, just a simple little melody. And I thought, yeah, you know, that's a nice thing to do. And I had my wife do some humming, and she sort of sounded like a mother humming a lullaby. And it just grew from there. So rather than a words or lyrics that I attached to something, it was really just that lullaby melody that, for the most part, became, you know, the core impetus for everything. So that's what that is.
And it's interesting because you included the piano versions of a lot of these dreams and then the orchestral mixes as well. And so to hear them evolve and to hear voices that, you know, might have been underneath the main melody in the piano version all of a sudden come to the fore because you've used an oboe or brass or the strings. And I'd love for you to just talk a little bit about how you made the decisions to, you know, orchestrate the various dreams.
You know, I wasn't originally, I was thinking, well, this will be a piano piece, and then this piece I'll do for piano and orchestra, and then this piece will be just orchestra. But as I kept going, I would listen to a piano version, for example, of the lullaby, and I kept wondering, am I going to start with piano and then bring orchestra in and then end with piano? That was one of the first ways I thought of doing it. But I kept liking and saying to myself, I want to have a full orchestra version of this whole piece. So I decided, well, I listened to the piano version and it stands on its own. It has its own feeling. And then I orchestrated it and I liked what that felt like. And it felt different. I mean, it's still the same music fundamentally, but it sort of hits you in a different emotional place, I think. And I'm not sure exactly why, other than the colors of an orchestra, like you said, like the hearing harp and flute and oboe play that opening is very different than hearing the piano just play that opening. So I remember when I was in college and I studied Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, and I, studied the piano version, and then I heard, of course, Ravel's orchestrated version. And anybody who's going to do orchestration studies that to look at what sort of decisions does a composer make or an arranger make going from piano to orchestra. And I always just really loved those two things side by side, the piano version and the orchestra version, and they really hit you completely differently, even though they're the same music. And I thought, well, I'm just going to share it this way. And that's why I did it. I just thought, well, number one, I don't have to write more music. But number two, I kind of feel like, well, a piano performance is just as valid as an orchestral performance. And it all came out of my head. So I want to share it with everybody. And it sort of flows together in this sort of, suite. And it kind of has its own internal logic why you're hearing this piece come back, but now it's in orchestra, or this piece come back and now it's a piano solo. And I just like the way it went together. So that's why I did that.
Thank you.
You had mentioned back when we talked a year ago about how you'd been listening to Erik Satie and his kind of spare harmonies and his simplicity, and I totally hear that in the solo piano versions. But what I really noticed this time with your orchestral versions is there's a kind of a wide open, like, American sound to them. Mm. You know, that kind of sound that Aaron Copland has, or these days, Mark O'Connor. And so was that intentional, or were you just in a place where that just had the right feeling for you?
It's hard to say what's intentional and what isn't, because I've talked about this before. Like, to me, it's almost impossible to do something that's just 100% unique and never been done before. And I think as an artist, you always are steeped in your own culture and things that you grew up with and things that you love. And you make a mistake if you then try to mimic whatever culture. But you can't really get away from the cultural influences that you have, and somehow you have to create something that at least for you seems new, even though it's going to have, like, you know, echoes of something that's comes from your past. And of course, you know, Aaron Copland is just absolutely one of my favorites. Samuel Barber, Aaron Copland. So I can't really walk away from those people. And when it comes to my harmonic vocabulary, I tend to, certainly I'm tonal, but I like sometimes the ambiguity of ninths and seconds, and rather than just pure triadic harmony, which of course then will get you back to, if you're doing open ninths and open string chords that are not super, you know, tertial, they're not super built up in thirds, but they're built up in fifths and ninths and fourths and things, you'll end up sounding like Aaron Copland. So there you go.
I didn't mean to imply at all that that your music is a rehash of Aaron Copland, because that's not the case at all. It absolutely sounds like you, but there's something just kind of iconic, I guess, about, like you said, those open fifths and open ninths. It just calls to mind America and the landscape.
Yeah, and that's what I love about, you know, Appalachian Spring or Lincoln Portrait. I mean, this is, for some reason, you just you hear those chords and you see the prairie and you see the, you know, waves of grain. I mean, it's just like, whether it's just because you grew up seeing that on, you know, somebody putting those two things together, or there's something just intrinsic about Copland's music that makes you feel, you know, giant, flat, open prairie spaces. I don't know what it is, but it is very American. And it's interesting because I think some of the guys at Highwire were sort of hoping that I would be making a more, some sort of Middle Eastern music, because they want this place to be sort of mystical and an almost Afghani kind of deserty thing. And I was looking into that, and it just wasn't feeling right to me. I don't know why. So yeah, it's going to feel, especially like you say, with no context of the game, because it's a prequel, you just hear it by itself. I think you're going to have some Americana images to what you have in your head.
Yeah, and what it really kind of brought to mind for me was the way Ray Bradbury created this fictional town, Greentown, Illinois, a small town, summer evenings, long summer afternoons, and white houses and front porches, and kind of a lazier time. I don't know why, but that's just what it brought to mind to me.
So. Well, and there's one section in one of the pieces, which I don't even know exactly where it came from, but to me, it kind of reminds me a little bit like, well, what is this? Is Gershwin just showed up? I mean, what is that? It's like this jazzy, sort of lazy Gershwin-y feel that, like, okay, I'm just going to go with it. That's the magic about not scoring picture, not scoring a game. Like the first time I did this was Music of the Spheres, and it was like just very generally related to what we knew Destiny was going to be. But I had this freedom to explore. And when Jamie, now for Highwire, said, hey, why don't you do another one of those? Do a music that's the prequel music to the game we're making. And I said, well, you realize that really is wide open. I can go in all sorts of directions, and I don't even know if some of this will be usable in the game. So, but I really enjoy it because it gives me this freedom just to sort of let things speak to me, and then I go in the direction they are taking me.
Yeah, well, without breaking any kind of an NDA, do you think that you will be able to use some of this in the game? Or, you know, the reverse side of it, has this music influenced the designers at all?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Yes, as a matter of fact, Jamie, you know, we did the trailer like 2 years ago, and it started with this humming of a melody that the mother, the fictional idea of this mother humming a melody to a child, and then the big golem comes in and it's all scary and stuff, and then we end with that little humming. Well, Jamie immediately started, as you started writing the script for the story, you know, the very first thing he has is like, yeah. And then we hear, you know, this character humming this melody. And I'm like, really? you want to now have that as part of the game? And he goes, yeah, it's like this magic melody that you hum.
Wow.
So now that it's in hindsight, it's going to seem like, oh, it was all part of the plan, but it's not. You're absolutely right. We play off each other. So the melody itself has actually become sort of a character in the game, which is fun. And then we're hoping to show the Golem song where the kids are singing. We have a trailer idea for that. That's why it's only, I think, a minute or so long, because it's going to be a trailer that introduces the game and introduces the world. And so that was Jamie's. He said, could we have kids singing something? And so we worked on that, and that's how that came up. It is fun when you're in the creative flow, how things can play off each other. Some of this music is in the game, so it is working right now.
That's really cool. And what's also, I think, an interesting process, and I know you did this with Myth and with Halo, you're right in there at the beginning, rather than getting handed assets and concept art and a design doc when things are already kind of set up. So it must be just a really fun process to where everybody, is starting from the same starting line pretty much.
Yeah, and that's the thing that I think Jamie and I both kind of missed as we sat with Bungie, working on all the Bungie games over more than a decade. The studio and the number of people involved got bigger and bigger and bigger, to the point where, wow, what happened to that really fun, creative process right at the beginning? There's just too many people now. The stakes are too large. So to be able to go back and just have a very small team, and the decisions we make, there's nobody to answer to, where we have to just go with it. It's exciting and scary, of course, at the same time.
Yeah, well, up on the high wire for sure.
Yes.
Well, I know you've been asked by a couple of other composers that I know about how music works in a VR game, because that's a really interesting challenge, and no one's like really cracked that yet. So, how are you thinking about that as you're working on the music for Golem now?
Yeah. Well, first of all, let's just admit that no one's actually cracked a VR game. 2016 was supposed to be the year of VR, and I never really believed it could come to maturity that quickly. It's been very hard. VR is here to stay. MR, all these different things are going to be influential and important in society somehow. And whether games are the cutting edge of this whole thing or not, I don't know. But we're trying to make a really good game that is compelling and immersive for people to play. And we have to solve that first. But to me, I still think if you're telling a story, music helps to tell a story. And unless it's what I think they call it, diegetic music, it's like music that's coming out of a source, like a
Yeah.
radio or a speaker that's in the environment. I still think music works just fine as something that's helping to just enhance the emotional journey the player is on while they're in this world. So even though, like, for example, doing cinematic moments inside VR is very, very different. You can't use camera cuts, you can't control the camera. At least for us, the player is the observer. So if you have characters that are interacting with the player and that they're telling a story, I still can bring music in, and it doesn't seem like you turn around wondering where the music comes from, because I'm going ahead and mixing that music as though it's a movie soundtrack that's in your head that's helping to sort of inform the player what the emotional context is. So music comes in and out. Music helps with transitions. Music's going to help you as you're going into encounters, and it's going to help enhance the scariness of something or the heroic nature of something. It still, I think, functions very much the same way. That's at least my attempt to use music in VR. I'm not worried about the fact that it's VR. Letting the sound effects and, the gameplay actually inform VR, but I'm still having music enhance the emotional journey that the player's on. And that happens inside your head. So that's where the music is.
Thank you. And then you've got the extra responsibility of doing the sound design for Golem too. So you get to decide where the sounds are going to be and how they work with the music and stuff. So it must be really fun to be able to get back to that.
Yeah, it is. And I was teaching at DigiPen here in Seattle a year ago, and there was a guy named Ian who I'm hiring as an intern to help me with sound design. He's doing just a great, great job. But it is hard. It's hard because there's always been a problem between creating sounds where you are comfortable creating things and then implementing them into a game engine and hearing how the engine and the environment of the game and so forth changes the sounds you're making. And then you have to figure out how to mix them and make them all play nice together. But with VR, there's one extra level. You can't just do it on your computer and stick it into Unreal and hear it play on a 2D screen. You have to get it up on its feet. First, you create the stuff, then you implement them, and then you see it in Unreal on a computer. And then you have to put it into the PlayStation VR system and really see and hear how things are. So it's been quite a learning experience for us. You can't do, you know, cinematic Foley the way you used to do it, because all these sounds are coming from real beings that are in the world. So you can't just say, oh, well, here's the footsteps. It's like, no, the footsteps have to be attached in the scene and do the exact thing that they're doing. And as you're listening to them, you can move your head around, and that's going to change everything.
Yeah, because the sound has to be directional too, I would imagine.
Yeah, and so it's like, sure, everything works out of context, everything sounds great, but all together and making sure everything's in sync and it's all mixing and playing well together, it's turned into a more of a puzzle than I was anticipating. But of course, this is what we knew we were getting into. We want to sort of be on the bleeding edge, and it is. It's bloody.
Well, you mentioned a while back that sometimes having technological limitations can actually be a good thing. Because then you're in your box and you can't go any further than that, than the boundaries of whatever, you know, that the technology sets for you. And then you really have to be creative. And so are you finding, as you're working on the sound design or the music, are there similar challenges or similar limitations with VR that you've been able to use to your advantage?
Well, that's interesting. So far, it's hard to see where the advantage is. You sort of like, wow, why can't I do it the way I used to do it? Why is this just not simpler? And I have a vision for how I want this to be, but to get to the end result is very painful. So to a certain extent, I guess, once it's sort of like once things work, you're like, okay, good, it works. Let's just move on. So the constraints mean that you can't spend forever polishing something. You really have to just, wow, is this working yet? And if it works, you know, we got to get the next thing to work. And but yeah, right now the constraints are difficult because the technology has gotten to the point where, oh, you can have as many voices as you want and you can have this great fidelity and you can do all this stuff and there's HRTF and it's all working. But then you're like, wait a minute. Now I think I have too much playing in the scene. I'm not getting any sense of 3D space because it's like there's too much. So we're learning as we go. It's like, yeah, I think I need to thin this out so it really feels like I know where all these sounds are coming from. So I think there's much more trial and error at this point than I was expecting because things change so much when you get it in the actual HMD engine with HRTF working. As a matter of fact, I mean, HRTF is one of those things, which I'm not sure how many people know what I'm referring to, but it's the thing that makes stereo headphones sound like there's three-dimensional sound. So it's called head-related transfer function, and it's a bunch of physics and programming that takes audio. And if you know where it is in three-dimensional space, you can make something sound like it's in front of you over to the left or behind you over to the right, supposedly, but you're still using just plain old stereo headphones. And because your ears are able to discern three-dimensional space in reality, you don't need more than two speakers if everything is working correctly with this head-related transfer function algorithm that's imposed on the physics of the audio. But sometimes it's really hard to know, is this really working? Does she really sound like she's walking behind me? Or, you know, like, as long as there's a visual cue, I'm starting to believe that I'm hearing footsteps behind me. But we're not throwing sounds into rear speakers. We're still coming out of headphones now. So I can't remember your original question. I apologize.
But. It was about technological limits. But what I'm really sort of picking up on here is that this is sort of like the Wild West of game development, kind of with VR. The way it was in like the late 90s, mid to late 90s, where there weren't all of these formulas for games anymore. And so there's a lot of experimentation, which is really exciting.
Yeah. And we have friends here in Seattle. I don't know how many former Bungie people have gone and started small independent studios, and they're all working on some sort of VR thing. We're still all friends, and we get together and sort of trade, learning experiences. But what's interesting is, like you said, there are no formulas, because the thing that sold, the Xbox, Halo was a seller for the Xbox, and, they're formulas that weren't known in 1999 for first-person shooters on consoles, but became, crystallized during the early 2000s with Halo and other games. And now we're at the same spot again with VR, where no one really knows, what's compelling, what's immersive, what really works. Is it better to, is a third-person platform game where you're controlling a little mouse like one of our friends is doing? Is that the thing that's going to be really compelling about VR? Is our version of VR where you actually lean and you walk wherever you want to walk, but as a doll or a golem? Is that going to be cool and compelling? I mean, we just don't know. Is it only cool to be sitting in the cockpit of a space, vehicle, shooting space things? Maybe that's the only thing that's cool. This world of VR is very interesting because of solving, like, yes, it's really compelling, but it made everybody sick.
Well, yeah, and that's another holy grail that everybody's trying to solve.
Yes.
I've got a couple of quick questions circling back to Echoes of the First Dreamer, and one of them is, as I was listening to those piano pieces, I was thinking, man, I would really love to play those. Do you have any plans on releasing the sheet music?
Yes, I'm glad you asked that. For the first time in my career, I own every part of this. I get to do what I want to with it. I don't have to go to some corporate people and say, please, sir, can I release this? I get to do what I want to do. And yes, I am going to release the sheet music for the piano. I'm going to release the scores, and however people want to perform it, I'm going to figure out a way to let them do that. And yeah, I will send you as soon as I have, nice piano sheet music for these things. I will gladly send you a copy.
Oh my goodness, thank you so much. The other question that I had is, if someone missed out on the Kickstarter but still wants to get the album, how can they do that?
Oh, that's another good question. Thanks very much. So it's being published by Something, SUMTHING, Something Distribution, which is Nile Rodgers' company. Nile and Something were the original distributors of all the Halo soundtracks. I think Halo actually was the first soundtrack that his company did. And now they've done, I think, hundreds of game soundtracks. We'll have information at HighWireGames.com and at somethingelse.com, and there'll be a site there that you can order the digital download, the CD, or the vinyl, believe it or not.
That's so cool. Yeah. I love that vinyl's coming back. It just has a completely different feel. It's a different experience, really, listening to vinyl.
Yeah. And I'm not, it's funny, because as a audiophile, or someone who really is interested in how audio sounds, what you have with vinyl is a different experience. It's a tactile experience, because you have this 12-inch piece of plastic in your hands, and you put it on the turntable and you put the needle on and you hear the little record pops, and it colors the sound. The process itself, it's an analog, mechanical process that colors the sound just a little bit. So it's not as pure and distortion-free and as all those other things as a digital version or a CD. But it does have its own sort of charm and quality to it. Like, anybody who gets the vinyl will also get a digital download and most likely listen to it on their iPods and however they want to hook it up. But you will have a little bit of a different experience with the vinyl. And I think people are coming back to vinyl because it's not so ethereal and esoteric, right? So like, yeah. What are digital just exists any place. And, you know, it doesn't really have any substance to it. But vinyl, you know, it's got a record jacket and a sleeve and it's big and you open it up and you see pictures. And it's sort of like, you know, getting a digital download of a game, but you don't really feel like you own something unless you get the box or you get an action figure.
Yeah, you're right.
So to me, the vinyl is sort of the action figure for the music industry.
That's an awesome way of putting it. Wow, Marty, it has been so much fun to have a chance to talk with you again. And I'm so happy that the Kickstarter was successful and this music is out there now. And really can't wait for the next step. Can't wait to see your music in the game. It's going to be great.
Oh, well, thanks so much. And I really appreciate you supporting and helping me tell people about this. And I'm glad you like it. And thanks very much.